In his new book, Gilded Rage, independent journalist and New York Times bestselling author Jacob Silverman delivers a searing expose on the radicalization of Silicon Valley, a peek behind the curtain at the tech and finance billionaires who are using their money and influence to steer a radical political revolution. As he follows men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel from early days of PayPal and Palo Alto to Washington, D.C., Silverman uncovers a sinister world where moguls preach populist revolt while dismantling the few remaining checks on their influence. This is the book you need to understand our current political moment and how tech and politics have become dangerously intertwined. Gilded Rage is available October 7th from Bloomsbury Continuum. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
Welcome to The Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation. On October 14th, Donald Trump announced that the United States had blown up a boat off the coast of Venezuela, killing all six people on board. It was the fifth such U.S. strike on a vessel in the Caribbean in the last 6 weeks. In total, 27 people have been killed in the attacks. Trump has claimed that these bombings are part of a fight against drug cartels, but there is no legal basis for this campaign. He's presented no evidence that anyone involved in these boats is connected to drug cartels, and the United States is not at war with cartels. None of the victims had ever been charged with a crime, and there's no evidence that any Americans were under imminent threat from any of them. Donald Trump flouting the law is sadly nothing new. But what do these attacks tell us about Trump's designs on Latin America and his effort to fully dispense with even the pretense that the U.S. is bound by international law? Greg Grandin is a longtime Nation contributor, the C. Van Woodward Professor of History at Yale, and the author of the recent book, America, America, A New History of the Americas. His previous book, The End of the Myth, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize, and many of the ideas in it were developed in our pages. I'm delighted to welcome Greg here today to talk about these strikes and what Trump is doing in Latin America. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Don, for having me.
So let's start with the question that your article poses, which is, what's behind Trump's Caribbean killing spree?
Well, it's also Marco Rubio's killing spree. And I mean, there's different ways of looking at it. It's obviously part of Trump's, drive to use violence and force and establish dominance in whatever way he can muster. You know, if Trump seems to represent a vision of the global order, of a fractured global order in which different superpowers administer their regional spheres of influence. And obviously what's going on in Venezuela and the threats against Mexico and the bailout of Argentina is all part of organizing the Americas in this imagined fractured balance of power. But, you could also look at it as divisions within the Trump administration itself. There are, believe it or not, there are moderates, or I don't know if I would call them moderates, but there are factions within the Trump administration that wanted to actually cut a deal with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela and start dealing with him as a sovereign, legitimate or not, virtuous or not, and begin to pump oil. And these interests, these so-called moderates are aligned with Chevron as opposed to Exxon. This all goes back to the Chavez years, when Exxon refused to Chavez's attempt at a nationalization of the oil industry in which Venezuela would own majority stakes in the oil company. Chevron went along with it and basically maintained a presence in Venezuela for a long time, although the sanctions placed on Venezuela, starting with Obama and then Biden and then Trump, have prevented Chevron from taking advantage of its presence in the area. But Richard Grinnell, who has the title Special Envoy for Special Missions, I need one of
he's,
those.
He's really special.
Yeah, he was Trump's ambassador to Germany during his first administration. I mean, he's an American firster, and he's an ideologue, and he's a diehard Trumpist. But he basically represented business interests, namely first among them Chevron, that wanted to normalize relations with Venezuela. And lo and behold, just a week or 2 weeks before the first destruction of a speedboat, of these go-fast boats.
That was on September 2nd.
Yeah.
Just to remind
listeners. You know, in the middle of August, Chevron got its exemption from and started pumping oil and shipping it to Port Arthur, Texas for refinery. And so in many ways, I kind of looked at this as Rubio's, and Rubio represents the war party. J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller, the head of the DEA, Pete Hegseth, and others.
Right.
You know, I see it as a bid to kind of blow that deal out of the water, literally. I mean, as a metaphor, which it did. You know, Trump basically, I don't know where the exemption stands, but basically Trump told Grinnell to stop negotiating with Maduro. So, this is a triumph of within the Trump administration of people who see Latin America in very ideological terms. Venezuela is the entry point to a reverse domino effect. They want to take out Nicaragua. The big prize, of course, is Cuba. And then with those countries, in line, they could start placing real pressure on Brazil. Yeah, and other countries that are governed by center leftists. They have a vision of Latin America. They, a much more ideological kind of anti-communist, but it's really anti-Cuban. I mean, when Maria Machado won the Nobel Peace Prize, there was celebration in Miami. They saw it, and I think they're rightly so. They saw it as part of this campaign to bring, finally, after more than a century, what we might call the Cuban Revolution or whatever state that has emerged from the Cuban Revolution.
There are so many strands here, and this is why I'm particularly glad to have you to talk about them. I'm intrigued and interested in this depiction of a conflict not just between factions within the Trump administration, but between Exxon and Chevron. I mean, When governments have withered away, and in the capitalist utopia that we're all hoping for, wars will be fought between corporations, obviously. And here's a little preview of what that might look like. Because after all, it's only states that have to pretend to be bound by international law. But I guess what I wonder is, on the one hand, for materialists, it's nice to understand the material basis of this conflict. But for most Americans, and I presume even for many of our internationalist-minded and enlightened nation listeners, why should we care?
Well, because it's pure murder. They've murdered Colombian nationals. They murdered Trinidad Tobago nationals. We finally have the names of some of the people killed. I mean, the first couple of episodes where we only saw videos of like a go-fast boat, and then suddenly boom, a flash of light, and it's gone, and you have no idea who was on it. None of these people are charged with anything. None of these people, there's no evidence presented that they were doing anything wrong, much less convicted. And the latest one, the Trinidadians, they seem to have been fishermen. I mean, these are boats that aren't coming to the United States. They're going to Trinidad. And if we want to grant that they may be involved in smuggling, and I'll say that Venezuela isn't the main source of it's, there's no fentanyl coming from Venezuela, and what cocaine that's coming from Venezuela is transshipped from Colombia, and most of the cocaine that comes into the United States comes actually across the Pacific through Ecuador and through the Pacific or up through Mexico. You know, there's very little, but there is some. But even if we grant that they were smuggling drugs, that they weren't coming directly to the United States. They would have. What the route is usually Venezuela to Trinidad, and then the cargo is transported, moved over, shipped, embarked on a bigger boat that comes to the United States. Like, these go-fast boats aren't, like, coming from Venezuela to the bayou of Louisiana, you know? This is all between Venezuela and Trinidad. That's where the fishing is, you know? And the thing, I mean, there's lots of aspects to this. You know, another material aspect for the materialist is that the Caribbean is environmentally imperiled, it's strained and stressed, and Venezuela and Trinidadian fishermen who used to fish close to their shores now have to go into deeper water to get their grouper and to get their marlin or whatever it is that the tuna or whatever it is they're catching. They have to go further out and further out from shore, and it seems like at least the family of one of the people killed in the last boat insists that that's what they were doing. They were fishing.
Right. So it's not really about drugs.
No.
It's more likely to be about geopolitics in the Caribbean, you know, which I don't remember, but you probably will. Who called the Caribbean an American lake?
Yeah, an American lake. I guess that's better than the Gulf of America, American lake. But that was the American lake was the whole Caribbean. The Gulf of America is just the
right.
Gulf of Mexico.
I mean, in other words, you know, and this is where your earlier book comes in. The myth that we learned in school was that the United States was an enlightened democratic power emerging in the 19th century, and these bad Europeans were coming in to reassert, you know, the darkness of papal dictatorship and autocratic rule. And it was the enlightened Monroe who said, you know, stay out of our backyard so that democracy could spread. Now, that's the myth. What was the reality there?
Well, the episodes that you're talking about is, you know, in 1902 to 1908, Venezuela really was the kind of a prelude in many ways to, you know, to World War One. You had Germany, Italy, Great Britain, and France sending gunboats in to try to collect debt. You know, Latin America was heavily indebted going back to independence, and we could talk about the reasons that was. But you know, you had European gunboats, and then you had Roosevelt, and you had Taft and Roosevelt, you know, President Taft and President Roosevelt, you know, trying to figure out a way to keep them out. And you had the beginnings of what were the U.S. signing on to something that looks like international law. I actually go into this quite a bit in the chapter that I call Tar Wars in America, because a lot of the conflict was over, not over oil per se, but viscous heavy crude that was used for asphalt. And as U.S. cities were paving their streets to make bicycle riding a little bit smoother, this party politics. There's one guy, Johnny Mack from Philadelphia. He presided over what was called the Mack Trust, and he tried to get a monopoly on all the asphalt coming into the United States, and a lot of it came from Venezuela. Jump forward 100 years, Richard Grenell is still importing. He's still involved in a business that imports asphalt from Venezuela. I mean, you know, you talked about the overlapping ways to think about this. I mean, there's so many registers one could think about this. On the one hand, you have the geopolitics, the need to get Latin America in order in this fractured sphere of influence. On the other, you know, that segues into this ideological campaign that, you know, driven by Rubio and all the anti-Castro, even though Castro is long gone, and they still identify themselves in opposition to a dead man. You know, that geopolitics segues into that ideological crusade. And then you have, you know, Trump, who wants to establish dominance with these shows of force, which is little more. It's obviously on a lesser scale. It's only 27 people executed extrajudicially, but it's the importing the logic of Gaza into the Caribbean. They're using overwhelming predominant force. You know, Lord knows what they're being bombed with, drones or helicopters, and they're being spotted by satellites, and they're just wiped off the face of the earth. 27 people who were convicted of absolutely nothing, civilians.
Who were not even charged with anything, let alone convicted.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the geopolitics, and particularly Venezuela, because I think, you know, one of the wonderful things about your book it flips the telescope. It not only tells us things about Latin America that we either were never told or had long forgotten, but it also gives us a view of the United States as an actor in the region from the South, which is not something that at least those of us reliant on English language histories have easy access to. So, you know, if you rely, as I'm afraid I often do, on the New York Times for your view of reality, you know that Venezuela is an economy in chaos, people are fleeing. Chavez may have been popular as well as populist, but Maduro, according to, you know, U.S. normal media, is consolidating a grip in ways that any decent Democrat would have to frown at. And I will say that, you know, in my very brief travels in Latin America last year, you come across scores of Venezuelans who have fled their country for either, you know, Argentina. I mean, obviously those who can get to the United States would try to get to the United States if they could, but many of them are living in Argentina and Uruguay and other countries deemed more stable and more friendly to migrants. So you hear a lot about Venezuela's troubles, and sometimes you hear that places like The Nation, which were very much enthusiastic about Chavez, bear some responsibility for, you know, the current state of chaos in Venezuela because the left were cheerleaders for this. So give us your view of all that.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, these have long trails, long roots going back to long before Chavez. You know, a lot, you know, back then, a lot of mainstream commentators drew a favorable comparison of Lula in Brazil compared to Chavez. Lula worked through the institutions, he was elected. You know, Chavez kind of ruled by decree and he was a populist. But it's important to remember that they came to power in two very different situations. Lula came to power in a very complex society in which the political institutions still existed. Chavez came to power in which the elite class literally collapsed. There was an enormous vacuum of power. And Chavez and Lula kind of worked together as a kind of good cop, bad cop. But, you know, on the one hand, look what they did to Lula. When he left office, they basically threw him in, they used lawfare, threw him in jail and impeached his successor, Dilma Rousseff. And those were people playing by the rules. Chavez made, in retrospect, we could say Chavez made a number of serious mistakes. He should have institutionalized the revolution. He shouldn't have relied on parallel power. You know, instead of like confronting the civil service and trying to remake the medical system and remake the political system, he just like he just created all of these misiones, these parallel things, which created contested, just deepened polarization in many ways. Chavez, you know, I think that Chavez had legitimate support. He won a series of elections overwhelmingly. When he didn't win one election, a referendum, he respected the results. So it isn't a question of like if one is a cheerleader or not for Chavez. He was democratically elected. The U.S. in 2002 endorsed a coup against him that had the participation of our new Nobel Peace Laureate, Maria Machado. Now, again, we could say that Chavez certainly there was an oligarchic intransigence in Venezuela that was profound, that stood against the mass democratization that Chavez's election in the late 1990s represented. And Chavez responded in kind. He wasn't Obama. He responded by provoking in kind in return. And what happened was this intense political polarization that was a reflection of the profound social polarization that long predated Chavez. And when he died in 2013, he also made the mistake of naming Nicolas Maduro as his natural successor. That, in retrospect, we could say was an enormous mistake. Instead of letting the different currents within Chavismo fight it out, and you know, kind of like the Mexican Revolution did back in the day, and you know, talking about different registers of history, you know, the Mexican Revolution had decades of chaos and violence, and nobody would say that the Mexican Revolution wasn't ultimately legitimate. Not nobody, but most people wouldn't. And so in Chavez, instead of allowing tensions, the different currents, the social movements, you know, the what was called the Bolivarian bourgeoisie, the people who got rich under Chavez, you know, fight it out for control, he kind of named Maduro, which obviously was a mistake. Maduro couldn't count on, you know, he doesn't have the charisma, he didn't have the oil revenues, because oil collapsed soon after Chavez died, the price of oil. So, and then the U.S. ratcheted up sanctions, so which only increased polarization. You know, I carry no water for Maduro. Sometimes I feel like being an historian, you have to operate in different registers of morality, right? You understand how radicalization happens historically in a hierarchy of power, and I think that's what happened in Venezuela. The real question is sovereignty. The real question, you know, whether you think that Maduro is legitimate or not, virtuous or not, you know, does Venezuela have sovereignty in the sense of who, you know, whether it's the U.S. is claiming the right to intervene in Venezuela and affect regime change. To go back to that conflict in 1902, 1903, 1904, that eventually made its way to the Hague Court, one of the first institutions of international law. And the president of Venezuela at the time was a dictator. He was no more virtuous than Nicolas Maduro. His name was Cipriano Castro. And the United States tried to argue at The Hague that because of his actions, because he was a thug or a villainous little monkey, as Theodore Roosevelt called him, that he wasn't protected by international law. And the Hague judge said no. They said it doesn't matter, you know, ill repute or not. It doesn't matter, you know, every nation is subject to international law and protected by international law, whether they are, you know, whether they are powerful and virtuous or poor and chaotic. And that's kind of my position.
Well, it's a really interesting point, and I want to clarify it a little bit, because, you know, sometimes when you read press accounts of what Trump has been doing in the Caribbean, they'll note that the United States is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, as if not signing a treaty confers impunity to international law. So, as you just said, every nation is subject to international law. So how does that work in theory and in practice? How might it work in this case?
Well, it's an ideal. It doesn't work in practice, right? The gap between reality and ideal has always been wide. Even at the height of the rules-based order, the United States certainly, I mean, we know the United States has a long history in Latin America. Sovereign is the nation that decides the exception, and the United States has long decided the exception in Latin America, whether it be in Guatemala in 1954, or Chile in 73, in Brazil in 64, you know, in Argentina in the 70s. I mean, we can go on and on. Nicaragua in the 80s. I mean, the United States, you know, Latin America in many ways, and this is the argument of the book, forced the United States, both because of its own interests and because, you know, it had to accommodate Latin America during the Depression and in the run-up to World War II, to abide by the principles of international law. That's the argument of the book. The United States only gave up the right of conquest because Latin America had given it up with their independence and had long insisted that the doctrine of conquest is invalid. And it wasn't until 1933 that, under Roosevelt, that the United States officially gave up the doctrine of conquest and began to abide by the rule of law. But it was also in Latin America where the United States, as soon as the Berlin Wall falls, begins to chip away at that. I mean, during the Cold War, the United States formally held to the ideal of multilateralism. So when it isolated Guatemala, it did so through the Organization of American States. When it invaded the Dominican Republic in 1965, it got the OAS to sanction it, you know, or it just did it covertly and didn't say anything, like in Chile, you know, Chile in 1973. But it was of course, in a case that's very similar to what's going on in Venezuela. It was in Panama in 1989, where the United States, you know, basically issued a police warrant, a summons for Manuel Noriega, an ally of the CIA, an ally of George H.W. Bush during the Cold War, who became unseemly. Ironically, and this is the dialectic at work, Cy Hirsch's article in the New York Times, which exposed just how nefarious Noriega was in spying and drug dealing and all sorts of bad behavior, that provoked a kind of reaction within the Bush administration, which came to power. Noriega wasn't high on the Bush administration's agenda when it came to power in 1989, but Cy Hirsch's article kind of set off a chain of reactions that led to the first Bush sending the Marines in. Ironically, you know, a couple of weeks after the Berlin Wall fell. And so there's to the degree that the United States was bound by international law, was to the degree that there was a superpower rival that it had to contend with. So therefore, it was it's rhetorically on its best behavior. But as soon as the Berlin Wall fell, the United States was off and running. And then, of course, there was, even before that, when the World Court ruled against the United States in its actions in Nicaragua, that it was waging an illegal war of aggression, bombing, mining its harbors, blowing up clinics, and funding the Contras. And the World Court ruled that it had to pay Nicaragua $17 billion in reparations. Reagan just withdrew from the jurisdiction of the World Court.
Right.
So, you know, this is Latin America we're talking about.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's what's kind of interesting in lots of ways. There are two points that I want to drill down into, and we can do them. Let's do them in this order. The first is the extent to which this attitude towards Latin America is a bipartisan thing. That this is, you know, Trump is a little more brazen. He's a little more big dogish in the way he uses American power publicly. But as you, or at least I won't speak for you, I'll speak for myself. When I watch what the United States does in Latin America under Trump, I think at least these guys know which side they're on. You know, if there's a dictator grinding the faces of the poor, if there's a corporation stealing the resources of the people, Trump is for them. But you know, when Biden came to power, having promised that he would restore relations with Cuba, which Obama had done, he had 4 years and he did nothing. So talk about the bipartisan history of this shame in our relations with Latin America.
Well, there's a timelessness to bipartisanship where you could point to different actions that Democrats have taken and that they seemed indistinguishable from Republicans in their willingness to intervene or to sanction interventions. I mean, Obama, coup in Honduras, the lawfare against Lula and Dilma in Brazil, coup in Paraguay, all took place under Obama's watch, and he basically endorsed all of those instances of which were an assault on the left. And then there's beyond timelessness, there's a sequential history here. There was basic, you know, the centrality of Clinton coming to power at the end of the Cold War and globalizing Reaganism in the form of market economics NAFTA being the crown jewel in this new globalized economy, and we don't have time to go into the devastation that that economy wrought, but it's worth saying that under Clinton, Clinton's three signature Latin American policies were one, NAFTA, two, the militarization of the border, which happened simultaneously with NAFTA and could be considered an, you know, the same policy in many ways. They were certainly related. And then three, Plan Colombia, the turbocharging the drug war, militarizing interdiction in Colombia, which had the effect of taking all of the violence that was concentrated in the Andes and telegraphing it up through Central America and Mexico. When we just think of those three policies that Clinton put into place, NAFTA, the militarization of the border, and Plan Colombia, you get a sense of how much we're living in a world that Clinton helped ratify. The consequences, the fallout.
So in a way, the flip side of that is the existence of an alternative approach, not often put into practice by the United States. But since we have the good fortune to have a historian, I want to ask a little bit about an alternative approach. And I'm thinking about, you know, when we began, you talked about this as a response to the nationalization or attempted nationalization of the oil industry in Venezuela as being more salient than any drug interdiction strategy. And I'm thinking about Franklin Roosevelt and Mexico in 1937. You know, so talk a little bit about what an alternative approach looked like when you had a president who was, whether naturally or because of force of circumstances and, for example, the Nazis' attempt to infiltrate Latin America, who was on the other side. What did that look like, and what were its effects, and what would that look like if that were to come to pass today?
Yeah. I mean, I go into this quite a bit. In many ways, this is the not quite the climax, but the golden years that the Edenic period from 1933 to 1943, the United States under FDR and under a lot, many left-wing brain trusters that within the FDR administration, Rex Tugwell, Henry Wallace, and others, basically charted a new course in Latin America that tolerated economic nationalism, that tolerated the expropriation of U.S. property, land in Mexico, that tilted the playing field in a way that had profound consequences. You know, Latin America, the worst fear of strategists leading up to World War II is that all of Latin America would become Spain. I mean, all the social economic indicators were similar to Spain, a small landed class, a militant peasant, a militant working class, rising socialism were in play in Latin America, and there were certainly plenty of Praetorian Catholics like Franco in Latin America. And the worst fear was that all of Latin America would fall to Franco-like dictatorships, and that would lose Latin America to Italy and to Germany. And that didn't happen. That didn't happen because the U.S. basically tilted to the left and supported, you know, and not just leftists, but, you know, people like Vargas in Brazil, you know, who was hardly a leftist, but he advanced social rights. He sought to rein in the power of the feudal class, which Roosevelt said was the seedbed of fascism. And for 10 years, you had the rise of a kind of anti-fascist Latin America that was fully behind the United States in the run-up to World War II, and saw World War II not just as a fight against fascism, but as a fight for social democracy. And this is the lesson from Latin America, that democracy in Latin America means social democracy. World's first social democratic constitution was in Mexico. When Latin Americans are asked to define democracy, they talk about healthcare, they talk about education. You know, they don't talk about proceduralism and the right to vote. You know, obviously that leads to the kind of turmoil and chaos and polarization when it's confronted with reaction, like you had in Venezuela and you have in other countries. But still, there's a lesson to be learned that you defeat fascism not just by fighting, not just being against fascism, but being for social democracy, being for a social conception of citizenship.
Well, I think that gives us a lot to think about here in the U.S., and I think it's a great place to finish. Greg Grandin, thanks so much for coming on the Nation podcast, and thank you for writing America, America, a book I urge everyone to read. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Don. It was a great conversation.
The Nation podcast is produced by Jack Merkinson and Adam Smith Perez. Our interns are Laura Noor Walton and Leo Miranda, and you can get us wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, host of The Nation podcast.